Welcome. My name is Henry Shelford. I'm CEO and co-founder of ADHD UK, and I have ADHD. This is the first in a series of deep dives. Today, we're deep diving into an area of major impact for many with ADHD, emotional dysregulation, starting with key question of what it is and how it impacts. And before we start, I've got to do the disclaimer, and I've got to introduce Dr. Shaimal Mashru, who is our expert and is going to be my partner in crime on this. So disclaimer first, there's no formal advice here, no medical advice, and you should always refer to directly to your relevant qualified medical professional. Right, that's it. And to say hello to Dr. Shaimal. Hello.
Hi, Henry. Thanks for the introduction. For the audience out there, my name is Dr. Shaimal Mashru. I'm a consultant psychiatrist, practicing both in the NHS in an adult ADHD service, as well as in private practice doing adult ADHD. So I guess my only disclaimer to the audience is that my main area of specialism is with adults with ADHD and comorbid disorders.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you for doing this and doing many more of these. So I'm looking forward to this. And this is our first. So one of my main goals is to make... Dr. Shaimal not have a terrible time. Go, I hated this. It was awful, awful. No, we've obviously spoken a lot, and he's absolutely great and extremely impressive individual with very high depth of knowledge. Right, okay. First off, big question, because I think this is the one of the tortures of ADHD, that almost every aspect of it has some fairly complex name that doesn't really communicate well. Like, even our name, ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, like, it's just a mouthful and not particularly useful when we're trying to talk about it. So what is emotional dysregulation? How does it impact people?
Right, so emotional dysregulation is essentially the difficulty of an individual to modulate or regulate their emotional responses to a situation. So the emotion is congruent with that situation. What that means is, if there is a sad situation, something that would make anyone feel sad, for example, the emotional response in an ADHD individual would appear extremely amplified. This can present in other ways, for example, with anger outbursts or irritability. So it's not that if another individual without ADHD was viewing that situation, they would say, yeah, I can understand that this individual's become angry. But that particular individual with ADHD cannot regulate the intensity of that emotional response. And that's really the best definition I could give of emotional dysregulation.
That means in a given situation, the ADHD's reaction is going to be bigger. That's if I summarize that. How does that differ from, let's say, a toddler? What's the difference between an adult and emotional dysregulation and a toddler? Like, because obviously we are operating in the day-to-day world. Like,
absolutely. So I think one of the key sort of, in terms of adult maturity and emotional maturity, one thing that most people can do is, a situation's gone wrong, something unpleasant, something they don't like, they will have an emotional response to it, but there will be a pause at some point, or a point of reflection, where they will say, okay, fine, let me bring myself down, calm down, and think about what can be done. In an adult with ADHD, which is maybe undiagnosed, untreated, etc., those emotional responses will be huge. And they will have a lifetime history of this type of emotional responses. So when they were children, it would have looked like temper tantrums, which was just uncontrollable. So I've had, parents say, one of their children, they just could not console them, for example, very different to their sibling, as an example. And that would have been a pattern that goes throughout their lifespan, because ADHD has been there throughout their lifespan. And then, in many ways, people will say, oh, they're just a child, so that's fine. So that will be kind of missed. And they move into adulthood, and those emotional outbursts are so strong that they're actually affecting people's relationships. both at home with their children, at work. And I think where it becomes significant is where it causes this functional impairment in different areas of people's lives. Now, if we look at the term ADHD, the last D is not a nice term, I guess, but it's a medical term and it says disorder. Disorder means that your symptoms are impacting functioning in multiple areas of your life.
Yeah.
So everyone will have a sense of an emotional response. We're not robots, right? To any situation. But if you can't bring yourself back to equilibrium, and you've gone out and, say, for example, had a total anger outburst with your partner, said some foul things, which we you know, can happen to everyone, and you constantly are doing this, then it's a problem. A part of emotional dysregulation then also leads to what has been referred by some researchers as emotional incontinence. Again, doesn't sound like a nice word. Doesn't sound like
names keep coming.
No.
Emotional incontinence. Great. Yeah.
But if you think about what that really is in its really brutal sense, it's all the emotion flooding out, right? So, and what does that...
This metaphor gets worse.
Don't worry. But essentially, what patients describe that as is, I feel overwhelmed with my emotions.
And that's it. And it overwhelms where we started this conversation, which is overwhelm is a really big aspect for many with ADHD, and it can be absolutely critical, particularly if it's happening in work. I mean, it's the part that can get you fired pretty quickly, and where you're overwhelmed and then not outputting. I want to just quickly sort of summarize, as I understood, what emotional dysregulation is. It's that essentially the emotional response is much bigger and much more latched into, and it overrides your intellectual response. And so you're just in there, and then not only you in there and then you're unable to respond intellectually in the way that you know you can in otherwise, and being locked in there. So what is it like? I think, what is the definition? What's overwhelm? Like, when someone's describing to you overwhelm, what are you hearing?
I think the core feature of this is people are feeling out of control. It's the lack of control. Yeah. So when you come back to dysregulation, another way of saying I can't regulate means I am not in control of my emotions at that point. Yeah. So if we look at ADHD, and this is what I'm more and more seeing this as a problem with self-regulation in general, it's actually a core feature of the condition. If we even look at the attention deficit part of ADHD, it's not a deficit of attention. It's a lack of regulation of attention. So attention is being dispersed in multiple different things. Similarly,
when I'm talking about, I completely agree. The phrase we use, it's not a deficit of attention, is lack of control of attention. I thought your slightly more sophisticated regulation of it is really nice. When we were talking previously, something that I found really enlightening was when you compared it, the difference between ADHD and BPD. And would you just talk to that for a moment?
Yeah. So just for the audience, when we say BPD, we're talking about, well, the different things going on here. So there's bipolar disorder. There are some key differences in terms of what we call chronicity or time spans, okay? First one is, as I touched on just before, people with ADHD have always had ADHD, whether they've been diagnosed or they haven't been diagnosed. So they'll have a history of childhood temper tantrums, which were far beyond many of their peers, yeah? Bipolar disorder, the onset is generally more towards early adulthood. So that's one difference. Number two is the length of time of onset and duration, right? So emotional dysregulation in ADHD is sort of 0 to 100 emotional response very fast. In bipolar disorder, you have episodes of what's called mania or hypomania, and episodes of depression that last at least a week at a time, normally longer, weeks, and weeks for the hypomania mania, and months generally for depressive episodes. The third difference is that the emotional dysregulation in ADHD happens following a trigger. The patient will be able to tell you, this is what happened, and that's what led me to blow up in this way. Or you did this, and that's why I've responded in this way. They can tell you that. In bipolar disorder, there's no obvious trigger. I've had patients that can literally have a few nights of not sleeping very well and go into mania. Similarly, waking up, just to coming out of mania, going into depression. There's no obvious trigger that's going on there. I think those are the differences between the two.
Yeah, I think that big piece around the difference of situational, like a situational linkage, like bipolar, not situationally linked and following those time patterns, ADHD very situationally linked. And
there's a fourth one, actually, just to add, sorry, which is an important one, which is called mood congruence and mood incongruence in medical terms. So in ADHD, so they'll have a mood congruent response. What that means is, if an external person witnessed this, they would say, yeah, I can understand that was an upsetting situation, so they got upset. But the intensity of the upset was very amplified. In bipolar disorder, it's mood incongruent. So that there might be potentially a tearful or sad situation. And if they're in an episode of hypomania, mania, they're responding in a mood incongruent way. They're laughing, they're finding it very funny or very excitable. It doesn't make sense to the situation that's going on around them. That's a fourth big difference.
Well, thank you. Like, and I think it's just interesting because in talking through different disorders versus ADHD, you actually learn quite a lot about ADHD. It helps understand us.
Can I touch on one thing before we move on from this topic?
Do whatever you want.
Which is very important. No, this is a really important one, actually, is when we're looking at treatment. If someone is presenting with these conditions, I just want to touch on this because this is a really critical thing, actually. If you go for an ADHD assessment, in my view, the psychiatrist must review for any other potential comorbid disorders. The reason why is if you miss bipolar disorder and potentially misdiagnose it for ADHD, or there could be bipolar disorder and ADHD, but the bipolar disorder has not been treated by a mood stabilizer, and you put that patient on a stimulant medication, they are at 10 times the increased risk of developing a frank manic episode. So it's critical for the person that's assessing you to know the differences and be able to tease those out in an assessment.
Yeah, no, and I think obviously it is important to look at, is it something else? Is it ADHD? Is it a combination? And I think one of the most it's one of the things that is tested for is whether or not you're just of low IQ. And I learned that, and I just had to reflect for a moment how ADHD can present as, be confused as low IQ potentially. It was a terrifying moment of reality check. You think that, and so emotional dysregulation and overwhelm, your view is it's so significant, so prevalent, that you think it potentially could be part of the diagnostic criteria. Is that right?
I'm absolutely, you know, I'm 99.99% sure of this. I go to a lot of research conferences. I'm sure you do as well, Henry.
But we also bumped into each other at the most recent large conference. Absolutely. So yes.
everyone that's working in this field, you see emotional dysregulation the literature says in untreated ADHD, it's 70 to 80% going to be present in someone's lives. I think it's higher than that, actually. I hardly ever not see it. I think it's more the rule, really. So we are, the main reason, coming back to my last point, of why it will probably be put into the next DSM, the next diagnostic manual, DSM-6, is because of the fact that if it's not put in there, it could be misdiagnosed for other conditions. And like I say, that's where it becomes a problem. So I have patients who have had histories of initially presenting with essentially emotional dysregulation to their GP, not even with classic inattentive symptoms. And they'll tell me a history of, I've been put on all the different antidepressants under the sun for many years. And actually, either it made me feel a bit worse or I felt emotionally numb. And that's because many antidepressants are working on a different chemical pathway to the pathways that are deficient in ADHD. And therefore, if their outward presentation of their emotions are coming from undiagnosed ADHD, they're actually being treated for the completely wrong thing. And that's why it's so important that it is actually put as a core feature of ADHD.
Yeah, and when you're saying, like, I think a lot of people think of, I talk regularly to people with lost decades to treatment to anxiety and depression, not ADHD. Most people talk about it just as being lost time. But you're saying that misdiagnosing because it's the emotional dysregulation that people are coming for, the treatment can have a negative effect. Can you talk a bit more to that, particularly around anxiety and depression?
Yeah. So the current thinking, and this is always evolving, right? Because in terms of adult ADHD, it's still a baby in terms of research. But the current thinking is that there's a dysfunction in two chemical pathways in the brain. The pathway involving dopamine and the pathway involving noradrenaline. And that is thought to be contributing to many of these ADHD symptoms. It's actually still unclear exactly how that's happening. So stimulant medication for ADHD looks to enhance the dopaminergic and noradrenergic pathways in the neurons in the brain. So if your emotional dysregulation is coming from deficient dopamine and noradrenaline, you need treatment for those two pathways. The majority of antidepressants work on what's called the serotonin pathways. Now, there is a very complex link between serotonin and dopamine and noradrenaline, but it's very indirectly linked. So what patients will often describe to me is, I've taken these antidepressants and I just felt a sense of numbness as opposed to a sense of well-being. And if you treat the emotional dysregulation that's coming from ADHD with ADHD medication, the interesting part that I found in my work is that patients will tell me, Doc, the biggest benefit that I had was I just feel emotionally much calmer than before. I'm not even bothered anymore about the attention and concentration. I mean, you know, that's almost a secondary benefit. The main benefit that's helped my life is that I feel this sense of emotional calm and I can better regulate my responses to situations. And my partner's noticed that. People at work have noticed that. It's quite a profound difference of effect.
No, thank you. And it's great you're reinforcing that and talking to it. It's obviously the reason we chose this as the first deep dive. You've talked already earlier noting how it impacts, one of the most impactful parts of ADHD, impacting personal relationships, work relationships with children and sleep. What about gender? Like, how does gender make a difference here?
Okay. So again, looking at the research and again, in my own clinical experience as well, the emotional dysregulation component of ADHD seems to be most prominent more in women than in men. Now, just for the audience out there, I don't want to, you know, any of the men jumping up and down saying, no, this is a big problem for me. It definitely is. It affects both genders. But I have had many female patients come to me saying that this is their primary problem. And actually, when they were researching more about their difficulties with their emotions, that's where they even came across ADHD. So it's not that they came across ADHD because their primary problem for their life was actually about attention, concentration, and fidgetiness. It was actually their emotional dysregulation. The second effect, where there's still very limited research, but there is more and more research coming out, is the impact between female sex hormones and the menstrual cycle and emotional dysregulation, as well as other ADHD symptoms. There's different elements in the menstrual cycle. So for a female that's having regular periods, so having regular menstrual cycles, in the few days or week leading up to the period, estrogen, which is a female sex hormone, falls. It reduces. If it didn't, you wouldn't have a period, right? We are now can see that there is a link between reduction in estrogen and dopamine and noradrenaline pathways, where a reduction in estrogen further impairs those dopamine and noradrenergic pathways that are already deficient in that female with ADHD. So they will describe a history of feeling far more emotionally dysregulated in those few days or week leading up to periods. And many of them might get diagnosed with PMDD separately. And then what they will say is, when they go towards ovulation in their cycle, where the estrogen levels are at their peak, they feel a bit more in control of their emotions. Take that forward as you go towards perimenopause and menopause, you are essentially going into states of lower and lower estrogen across the whole cycle until you're eventually not having periods. Many women will say, I was struggling with my emotions before, but now I'm just finding I absolutely cannot cope. And it doesn't just affect the emotional element. It also causes other symptoms of heightened ADHD inattentive symptoms, where they'll describe things like brain fog, increased forgetfulness. Some people have actually thought they're developing early stages of dementia. They've gone for memory tests, etc. And that's the link that we can see there in women with estrogen, lowering of estrogen and ADHD symptoms, including emotional dysregulation. In men, this is sometimes displayed more as irritability and anger symptoms. And it's very, very new research, but they're now looking into the impacts of the over the lifespan of lowering of testosterone and similar impacts on these types of ADHD emotional symptoms.
Thank you. I think that obviously in ADHD, the discussion between gender differences and frankly, any difference beyond male, like, so when we're looking at ethnic diversity and the research, has a lot of catching up to do. And so I think it's important we try and talk about the information we have. And so thank you for doing that. Now, I think what would be good to do is talk a bit more about, you talked previously, we were talking about the lack of the pause, the lack of inhibition means losing the pause, no gap between thought and speaking. The lack of inhibition is a slightly different part of emotional dysregulation. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at, Russell Barkley's a very, very famous sort of American psychologist regarded as one of the godfathers of sort of ADHD. And Russell Barkley talks a lot about the emotional dysregulation being part of almost impulsivity symptoms of ADHD. And what is going on behind impulsivity? What does impulsive mean? Impulsive means disinhibition, a lack of inhibition. So when we break down what's going on in really simple format, we said that there is a trigger, a situational trigger, and then there's this emotional response. What's going on between that trigger and that emotional response between someone with ADHD and someone without ADHD potentially? In that process, the patient with ADHD has a very pronounced loss of inhibition. They are not able to inhibit that response. We see this with other impulsive symptoms of ADHD, where people will say, I keep interrupting in conversation. It's the loss of inhibition, almost like a lack of patience. And that produces that emotional response. If you have a loss of inhibition, you don't take any second to reflect on does this situation actually require this level of emotional response? There's a loss of rationalization of what's going on. This is if you're really breaking down what's happening there. And that's what I mean by loss of inhibition.
Well, it's obviously a very important point. And that lack of the pause. And so what is, how does something like rejection sensitive dysphoria fit in with this?
So rejection sensitive dysphoria, again, is not part of the diagnostic criteria. It's not a formal symptom.
But it's something you think might be included in the future, which is a big deal, right? Because at the moment it's got very low levels of research backing, but it's something that you say to people and it resonates with them instantly. I'm really keen to learn more from you on this.
So rejection sensitive dysphoria, essentially, so dysphoria comes from the Greek word, which means intense pain or suffering. And the rejection sensitive part is talking about the fear of failure or rejection. And the emotional response is almost felt like the patient will almost say, I felt wounded. It's so potent. And that's what that dysphoria word comes from. So this, again, has been shown to be more common in women than men, but I've certainly seen this in men as well. And this has huge impacts in different people's lives in different ways. I'll give you some examples of this. I've had patients tell me that I didn't apply for that job, even though I was more than qualified to apply for it. Yeah. Because I'm so scared of the fear of not getting that job. In other ways where it's impacted is people have developed very strong defense responses. So your employer or your partner or someone has given you some feedback, and then the response has been very defensive. And they were trying to sort it, and they always have to say, hang on, I'm not trying to be offensive here. I'm just trying to give some constructive feedback. But it's not.
I think when you talked earlier, where you said it's painful like a wound.
Yeah.
Like that, I have to say that hit home for me, where I know that I've had those feelings of rejection and failure, and it really hurts.
And where it has other impacts is, I've even had patients who told me that they stayed in relationships that were really not good for them and that they shouldn't have stayed in because of the fear of rejection. They've been people pleasers. They've tried to make everyone else happy around them at the sort of cost of their own happiness, actually. So they've not had that boundary of saying no. They've become patients have said they've become more perfectionist. But not in a productive sense. So there's another thing that we talk about.
Perfection's hardly ever, like, it's normally, like, nothing's perfect, right? Like, so it's pretty
unattainable. I've had patients who tell me,
from this obviously this discussion, which is clearly perfect.
I've had patients tell me that their perfectionism actually stopped them from starting certain complex tasks. And what's that called? Procrastination. That's a symptom called procrastination. When you really dig into procrastination, many times RSD, rejection dysphoria, is playing a role here, because subconsciously the person is so worried about getting it absolutely right because of a fear of failure, a fear of rejection, etc., that they don't even start it.
And are you saying that the essentially rejection sensitivity dysphoria is a part of emotional dysregulation? And what you're saying is that people have, from learned experience of the feeling they get, the wounded feeling from failure of rejection, they then quite rationally, knowing that level of pain, that they then don't do things, that they stop, they won't do it, they'll stay in a relationship, they won't start a major project, they won't apply for a job out of fear of that.
Absolutely. And this touches on another, I'm going into segues a little bit here, I appreciate. But
I think in an ADHD environment, it's something that we are very comfortable with.
I think you know, there's been a lot of mention around trauma and ADHD, right? So if we look at rejection sensitive dysphoria, why is that there? What, if you think across the lifespan of an undiagnosed person with ADHD, why have they developed a fear of failure and rejection? Because throughout their life, they have essentially found that despite their best efforts, or they're working so much harder than the people around them to achieve, and still might not be achieving as high as the people around them, they then get labeled. So if they're procrastinating because of, you know, they're like, well, I got it wrong last time, so I don't know where to start with this task. What do I do? They're deemed as lazy, or they're deemed as, well, you know, I just don't understand. You know, Charlie's a bright kid. Why is he not getting top grades? Why is he not fulfilling his potential? Over time, that starts impacting your self-esteem, because those are little traumas that you're experiencing from society around you, maybe even also from your parents. And so that gets into your psyche. And as you get older, you develop low self-esteem. And then you start to doubt yourself. And then you start to say, am I good enough? When you start to say that a lot, am I good enough? That will impact you in so many ways. Because if I am not good enough, then I'm going to potentially fail this task. So what do I need to do? I need to make sure it's perfect. I've got to make sure it's perfect this time, because it's never perfect. And then you get, and actually coming back to emotions, you get emotionally overwhelmed. So what do you do as a natural human response? You push back that task. You push back that task. Oh, I know I've got to do it. I'll do it tomorrow when I'm in a better state of mind. Until there is absolutely no choice. The deadline is tomorrow morning, and you're frantically doing it at that point. And at that point, your noradrenaline levels, which have been low, shoot up. Your adrenaline shoots up. And then people will say, they'll almost think of it as, well, I needed the threat of that deadline to get it done. You hear this all the time. So coming back to, where does the rejection sensitive dysphoria come from? Well, it's because those repeated traumatic messages that you're getting since you've been a child, all the way going through, when you go to uni, when you go to jobs, it kills your self-esteem. And then you develop rejection sensitive dysphoria. That's what I think is the pathology of what's going on.
Honestly, it's pretty painful listening to that. Like it does hurt a bit inside. Okay, what can we do? Let's talk treatment and what makes a difference.
Yeah. So coming back to then our topic, which is obviously emotional dysregulation, even RSD is a part of that. Broad brush speaking, there are really two real forms of treatment, like in most elements of mental health: medication and therapy. Now, in terms of medication, there are really no licensed medications that specifically are treating emotional dysregulation and rejection sensitive dysphoria. However, there are some treatments that have shown some promise. So what's known as non-stimulants or alpha agonists, that's a medical term. So medications like guanfacine or potentially atomoxetine have shown some promise in helping reduce or dampen the emotional response that people are having to certain triggers. The other side, so nowadays, what many psychiatrists are doing is they're combining stimulant medication, which is very good for traditional executive dysfunction, and it can also have a benefit in terms of emotional regulation as well, and also using a non-stimulant alongside that if the emotional dysregulation is a very prominent feature in that patient's symptoms. Now, I have to caveat this by saying this is definitely not licensed in the NHS, for example, in the UK, because there's still not enough research to really prove how beneficial this is. In terms of non-medical treatments, so these are certain types of therapies like coaching, ADHD coaching. So a good coach, when we go back to when we said there's a loss of that pause or a loss of inhibition, a good coach will work on your cognitions. So we'll introduce a form of CBT therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, into their practice, which essentially forces that patient to keep practicing, reflecting on that situation before responding. So it's a learnt practice that they have to keep consciously doing until it becomes automatic. Other techniques, very similar, things like mindfulness. Mindfulness is essentially sort of taking a time out and saying, right, let me just pause and stop. Okay, what's the situation that we've got here? Are there any practical solutions? What's the implications? And essentially taking a step away from that situation so that there's less emotional overwhelm. So in an ideal world, you would want to have a combined treatment of both medication and therapies. Medication might help, I would say, more in the short term, but the therapies, definitely developing techniques, can help in the longer term. And whilst I'm not a child specialist, I know one of the techniques that they use for children, for example, is distraction techniques. So child doesn't want to go to school, they're really kicking off. Rather than spending an extra 5 minutes forcing them into the car, take them to the side, maybe play with them for a few minutes. Yeah, you're going to be a few minutes later, but you distract the child, put them into a better mood, and then try taking them to school. So these are the different types of techniques, but broadly speaking, you're talking about medication and therapy.
Thank you. And obviously, like, for the actual medication part, people need to talk to their practitioner. I have to put that. Just always feel like you've got to say that multiple times, and that you're giving rounded advice on what sort of options are available.
Absolutely. And I really want to caveat and say certain non-stimulants are definitely not licensed yet in the UK for this types of treatment. You're seeing this a lot in the US and Canada. I think probably more advanced, if I can say so, but we are seeing this being tried out more, a lot more in sort of non-NHS practices and showing good promise, actually.
Oh, great. No, thank you for sharing that. I think it's obviously very important. I think, look, in this area, we've covered, gone into emotional dysregulation, covered how important it is, how significant it is. And I think one of the really big takeaways for people is, like, this is one of the really big deal aspects of ADHD. I had to hold myself back when you're talking about the sort of knock-on impacts around, you know, procrastination, working to deadlines and using deadlines and how they impact, because those are all things that people talk to quite directly because they're the sort of more tangible elements that they know of. But the step back is it's all coming out of this emotional dysregulation. It's this lack of pause. It's this challenge we have, and so it's been great, and thank you for all your time and in talking through it and giving us this deep dive, which has been wonderful. The I think this is where we sign out. He's checked. There's nothing else you want to cover this particular thing.
Well, I guess there's only one last thing I want to actually touch on, actually. If we don't
is count. It that I'm wonderful? Because that's a good topic.
Yeah, yeah. We can do a whole other deep dive about you, Henry. And how
we should not do that.
on this one thing I think that I want to touch on, just because I think the audience might be quite interested in this, because I get this asked a lot, is when we were speaking about the impact of female sex hormones on ADHD symptoms and emotional dysregulation, many people are now starting to wonder about other treatments alongside their ADHD medications targeting hormones. So there's very little data about this. In fact, the Attitude magazine did surveys about this very recently about the impact of HRT on emotional dysregulation. And what they found was that in about 1 in 4 cases of people that are using HRT, that significantly improved the emotional dysregulation that many women were experiencing during perimenopause and menopause. So I think that's just something, I mean, that's an area that's going to be probably researched a lot more into, but that's something to bear in mind, actually, as well.
Thank you. Obviously, it's an extremely important point. And I was talking with someone doing some ADHD research right now, and discovered that every single one of their participants was male. I honestly couldn't believe it. I was like, "You're kidding me!" Like, just that sort of need to do more female-based research and more diverse research is massively important, and what you're talking about is that as people are starting to do it, they're finding very, very important findings and potential to make a very big difference for people, and underlines the importance. Right, we've got to sign out. I need to thank you, Dr. Sharmal. You've been wonderful. I'm looking forward to doing more of these with you. I'm going to put at the bottom, so for people, that is the link to Dr. Sharmal's private clinic. He also works within the NHS if you're lucky enough to be in his area, and it's adhdhealthclinic.co.uk. Yeah. If you're watching, if you're seeing this on the website, there'll be a link in his bio as well. That's it. Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Sharmal, and yeah, it's been wonderful. I've learned a lot, and frankly, like in some parts, frankly, hurt a bit. Like, you know, when you're hearing the reality of towards your own life, it's great.
And I think just to end on a positive note, being more aware of this can then open the door for treatment, right?
Absolutely. No, it changes it because it means you know what actually you're trying to target and challenge. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Henry. Cheers.
And that just leaves me to sign out, say thank you very much. Obviously got to do the bit where we're a charity, right? I can't tell you how tight money is, and all donations or fundraising are essential. We receive no government funds. It's the only way we do everything we do, and we can't do anything without. So thank you. And it's harder for us. ADHD is a stigmatized condition. Lots of people don't want to shake it in, go out and talk about it. And so the people who do it is incredibly important. Thank you. Well, again, it's a thank you to Dr. Sharmal for doing this. He's wonderful and hugely appreciated. And hopefully he had a good time. We're going to do it again and again. So thank you. Okay. Goodbye.